So I just want to begin by thanking Mrs. Kraft and everybody who is here this evening. So it's a special opportunity for me to get together with this very august group. But it's particularly special because now, having seen the development of this project of NEALI, of the women's learning, it's really something that we as a community should be very proud of and something that we should reflect on during this time of reflection and appreciate that which we have, the opportunity that the Kollel has had to be a part of the community in this specific way, and now having our own director, someone on the professional staff who brings the scholarship and the wisdom and the warmth, the knowledge, is something that's special, and please God, it's going to see the program continue to grow. So for all those who continue to make that happen, we are very grateful. Just last night, there was a high school girls program that had nearly 60 girls from different high schools participating with mentors and student leaders, which was really outstanding. So we thank everybody for enabling that to happen in various ways. Personal Hakar Satov goes out to several teachers and mentors and colleagues of mine who helped put together different ideas that we're going to be sharing tonight, specifically my teacher, Dr. David Pelkovitz, because we're going to talk a little bit of psychology about change, and then a few items from Rabbi Jacob J. Schachter, as well as Rabbi Josh Flug. But it's really amazing. When you look around the room, what started as a small project in someone's dining room for a group of women who weren't able to get to a Shabbos Shuvah Drasha has become something that's really an amazing opportunity for us to come together. The only downside is that when we have a reality check, and that is that generally when a person goes to a Tshuva Drasha, so the Tshuva Drasha is delivered by someone who is seasoned, who is wise, who is exceedingly pious, and that's certainly the ideal when we think about where to look for a Tshuva Drasha. But unfortunately, I'm very keen on self-awareness, so I make no claim to any of those qualifications, unfortunately. And so, kind of when I'm reflecting and preparing these remarks, I'm really speaking to myself most directly. These are things that I need to work on, among many, many other things. So I'm sorry that you don't have someone who is pious who's sharing with you these words. First of all, on yutorah.org, you can find plenty of those. But for tonight, you'll have to make do with what I have to share, but perhaps it's more bevechinas in the realm of sharing a journey that I'm working on rather than someone who has actually accomplished something in this realm. So that's the important preamble. I want to begin with with a short story, a story of two young women. So these girls grew up together. One of them is a little bit older, about 4 or 5 years older than the other, and the senior girl is like a mentor to this other girl from the neighborhood. And they were extremely close, and the older girl would constantly keep an eye out and make sure that the younger girl had everything that she needed. Sometimes she struggled, and the way that it kind of developed was that this older girl was extremely successful in all of her endeavors, and then the younger girl had many, many vicissitudes, many challenges. So the older girl all of a sudden becomes a young woman and matriculates through school, and now she's extremely successful. She's a business person, and she has a very, very successful company. And the younger girl is struggling mightily. And this older, the woman who is the mentor, keeps very close tabs on this younger woman, and they keep in close touch, and the younger woman really relies on her mentor for everything. And the one interest that this older mentor has is that she happens to have a unique collection of automobiles. She collects cars, very, very exclusive cars. And one day she gets a phone call from the younger woman asking a small favor if she could borrow one of the cars, one of these collectibles that's sitting in an airplane hangar not far away, if she could borrow this car for an interview, because she had been interviewing in a certain company, and she had mentioned in the interview that she has a friend who has a collection of cars. So the mentor says, no problem, you can borrow any car that you'd like. So the younger woman says, You know, I know that recently you purchased a McLaren P1. Now, McLaren should not be confused with McLaren the stroller. The McLaren car is a car that costs somewhere to the tune of $1 point something million. She said she'd like to come by and borrow the McLaren. It's an English automobile. And she'd like to take it for a ride. So the mentor says, no problem. No problem. She says, on Tuesday, there will be somebody at the hangar. You can come take it out. You have a meeting on Wednesday. So come Tuesday, take out the car, and you'll bring it back Thursday, no problem. So Thursday comes, and the younger woman has to make a very, very uncomfortable, very difficult phone call. She can't even bring herself to make this phone call. Because on her way back from the meeting, she was a little bit careless, and as she was making a right turn without looking, she clipped the side of a telephone pole. And now there's a huge, awful-looking dent in the side of this McLaren P1. So she has a lot of problems right now. So she knows she has a subsequent interview coming up. She doesn't have any other mode of transportation. She's going to have to take the bus. But worse than that, right now, she can't face her friend, the mentor, that has given her everything and gave her the most expensive car in her collection, and she wrecked it by being careless. So she's schwitzing and she's embarrassed and she doesn't know, so she sends her a text and she says, something happened with the car, I have to bring it back, but you don't want to see it, I'm so sorry, I feel terrible, I would call you, but I'm too embarrassed. So she realizes this comes Thursday, she has to drive the car back. So she comes back with the car on Thursday, and she rings the doorbell of this beautiful home, and she realizes she can't take the car to the hangar because she has to bring it to the house. It's going to have to be repaired by a specialized repairman. So she rings the doorbell, and the housekeeper answers the door, and the girl puts her bag down. She has, you know, one of these like handbag things. She carries whatever you put in there. You have stuff. So you put it in the bag. She puts it down and she reaches into the bag and she takes out the key. It's just one key. And she gives it to the housekeeper and she says, I know that I should really come in, but I can't stay. I can't stay. So the housekeeper says, just give me 1 second. She takes the key. She brings it inside. She puts it down in the kitchen. And meanwhile, the young woman is just looking around and feels so, so bad. She looks around this beautiful home with everything being kept in absolute perfect condition. And she looks outside in the driveway, and here's this McLaren P1 that's worth over $1 million that has a tremendous dent in the side of it. And she's just, she feels like nothing. And she really let down this mentor, this woman who took care of her all this time, and she was so careless. So she feels like absolutely like nothing, and she's kind of daydreaming. And the daydream is kind of interrupted by the housekeeper saying, hello, hi, have a good day. So the young woman immediately grabs up her bag and she runs out and she heads down the driveway. Around the corner there is a bus station, so she's going to take the bus back to her apartment where she lives, and she'll figure out some other mode of transportation. And when she gets to the bus station, so she opens up her special bag, you know, that bag that you carry with all the stuff in it, and she opens the bag to take out some change from the purse that has 500 different zippers and compartments. And before she can get to the purse, she sees a little, just a small envelope. And she opens up the envelope, and there's a tiny little note. And she recognizes the handwriting on this note. And the handwriting is this mentor's unmistakable handwriting. And the handwriting says, mistakes happen. I'll always be there for you. And underneath the piece of paper is a key to another car. That's a story. But that story belies such an important truth that we need to internalize this time of year. Because there was a great and pious man. His name was Rav Shlomo of Radomsk. He wrote a sefer called Tiferes Shlomo. And he says, you know that what is one of the biggest impediments that we have in this time of year is that we don't believe in ourselves. We believe that either the things that we've done have been so egregious, or the distance that we have to travel is so far, or that it's not really for me, I'm just a regular, ordinary person. The Ribbono Shel Olam, the master of the universe, there's no way that I can reach, that I can aspire even to what I need to become. And we feel like it's almost out of reach. So in 1833, as Rosh Hashanah approached in his small Polish town of Radomsk, he gave a lengthy drasha. And he said, the first thing we have to remember is that these things are all false. They're all absolutely untrue. And that we need, before we even begin any discussion about finding ourselves, about the process of tshuva, we need to remind ourselves that we can't give up on ourselves. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't give up on us. The fact that this past year, maybe the car that he gave us has a little dent, maybe it has a few dents, maybe it's not even the same car, maybe it got totaled. It doesn't matter, says the holy Tiferet Shlomo. He says the Ribbono Shel Olam believes in us, and his proof is, he says, that everything in the world, all that Hashem created, is l'chvodo b'rasiv. It's kol l'chvodo. It's all in the honor of Hashem Yisbarach. And the fact that I'm still here obviously means that the Ribbono Shel Olam has a mission for me, and that there's a purpose for me still being here, even though I made all of those missteps. So the fact that I'm here, hayom atem nitzavim, hayom, I'm here today, that means I have a job to do. That means the Ribbono Shel Olam believes in me enough that I should wake up this morning and have a purpose in my day. We say in the morning, when we get up, we say, Moda ani lefonecha melech chai v'kayam. We acknowledge the Ribbono Shel Olam for giving us back our soul. Shehechzarta bi nishmasi, you have given us back our soul. Bechemla, with compassion. Rabba emunasecha. So I always thought that that means Rabba emunasecha, that we have a lot of faith in Hashem. But if you look at it precisely, for those who know Hebrew, you can translate it as Rabba emunasecha. You have a lot of faith. The fact that you woke me up today is because you have faith that I'm going to accomplish something, that I am here for a reason. And so whatever happened in the past is not going to stop me from accomplishing my goals moving further. So as we approach Yom Kippurim, the Yom HaKadosh this week, we're thinking to ourselves, wait a second, we got to think about tshuva, we got to think about this process of finding ourselves and bridging the gap of who we are to who we ought to be, but we can't give up. No matter how far we've gone, no matter what's come before us. Whatever happened, that's not really material to the process of tshuva. So the process of tshuva, it's complex, and we can look at it in many different angles, but one way to look at it is in terms of the process of change. Right? Many people would associate tshuva with change and personal development, finding out who we are. And to bridge that gap, sometimes we need to make changes. So there is a psychologist, there is actually a very, very prominent scholar in the University of Rhode Island. His name is James Prochaska. James Prochaska is a name in psychology who is renowned for his theory about change. And he has a principle, he has a theory. It's a lengthy, it became a book called Changing for Good and an article. It's a very interesting model. And essentially, he suggests that we go through six stages whenever we affect change in our lives. And it's a fascinating way to think about things, and as we go through these stages, we can all reflect for ourselves how we've changed over the course of our lives and how those changes maybe have gone through these stages, and how sometimes we can identify actually in different areas of our life, we're actually at different stages in this process. So he identifies different times. There were five stages or six stages, so we'll mention six, although five are really the ones that are operative. So the first stage that he identifies is pre-contemplation. Pre-contemplation says that we really have no intention of changing anything right now. We're really fine where we are. We don't want to be nagged by other people. We're not contemplating anything. We're in pre-contemplation. If there's something wrong, we're blaming others. We're not really focusing on ourselves. People might even feel hopeless and demoralized because they're not, right now, they're not in an active process of change. That's the first stage. The second stage
He calls the stage of contemplation. This is where we acknowledge a problem and we start to seriously consider changing this problem. We know the goal, but we're not necessarily sure exactly how we're going to get ready. And people, sometimes we get stuck in contemplation for a long time. We're afraid we're going to fail. We're not really sure what direction we could take. But we realize that there's something that needs to be worked on. The third stage, he says, is preparation. This is where, in this stage, most people, they're planning to take action within the next month. We're going to do something in the next month. And now people start talking with other people about what we're going to do. So some people in my family know that occasionally I want to try out various diets. Just because if I'm gaining too much weight, so it's kedai to cut back on what I eat. So sometimes I can be in pre-contemplation. No, I don't need to go on a diet. Then the contemplation, really, the truth is, I should really work on it. And then preparation is, I'm starting to make a plan. I'm coming up with an idea, a detailed scheme, and I come up with a plan, which is generally moderately successful, which is only one dinner a night. That is good dinner. For those who are looking, I'm not generally a dietitian, but I would tell you that that's a good plan. One dinner a night is good. But then, the fourth step, according to Prochaska, is action. And this is where the person, he says, you make the move for which you have been preparing. It requires the greatest commitment, the time, and energy. And there, this is actually the stage in which your changes, the development, is actually most visible. The fifth stage is what he calls maintenance. So here I am, I decided I'm only going to eat one dinner a night. Only one dinner. But I'm in my office in the basement. It's now 11:45 and I'm getting hungry. So now it's really time for a second dinner. So in my head I'm thinking, second dinner, but I told myself I wasn't going to eat the second dinner. So how long can you maintain this process of change? And finally, the last process, which is part, it's somewhat debatable, it's what he calls termination. That's when you reached your goal, you've conquered this. You never worry about going back for a second dinner. You're beyond that completely. So these are, according to Prochaska, the five or six stages of change. So if you were to think about it, perhaps one way to look at this is that this is actually the way that, in a certain sense, that our year is structured, certainly as it relates to Yamim Noraim. So in a certain sense, over the course of the year, I would say, and I'm generalizing, I don't know if anybody can see this now that it's on this chair, but over the course of the year, unless we're extremely spiritually attuned, which we're ideally supposed to be, but I can't say that I'm always on that ball. So very often, I'm in the stage of pre-contemplation. So we'll call this a year-round. Everything is going fine. I don't really need to make any drastic changes. I'm good where I am. And then all of a sudden, they start blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, on Rosh Chodesh Elul, and everybody starts talking in the world of the yeshiva, for those who were ever exposed to reading about what life was like in certain European yeshivot, people would go almost mad. They were so caught up in the scene and the mood of Elul and the focus. So today it's not quite the same, but all of a sudden during Elul, I would say in a certain sense we're like in the contemplation stage. It's like, you know, maybe I do need to go on a diet. Maybe I should start thinking about what I've been doing and how I've been acting and the my relationships. But for many of us, myself first and foremost, Elul, it is a time where we're thinking, but can I honestly say that during Elul I have like a Kabbalah? Am I fixed yet? I don't know. Some of us are still going about our regular time. So here we are in Elul. We're in our contemplation side. And then in our third stage, all of a sudden now, we're in our preparation. And that's when we hit Rosh Hashanah, I would say. Because on Rosh Hashanah, we spend a good chunk, maybe half of our day, or a quarter of our day, or a significant amount of our day, focusing on what we're supposed to be doing. We're thinking about Yom HaDin, whether we're in shul, or we're at home, whether we hear the shofar, or we don't hear the shofar. All of a sudden, we're taking a break from everything that's going on, because during Elul, we're still doing our errands, we're still going to work, we're still driving carpool, we're doing all the things that we're doing. But on Rosh Hashanah, that all stops. It's
especially if we make it to shul and we hear the shofar. So all of a sudden, now we're in preparation. Now we see, you know what? This is serious. We hear the chaz, and he starts talking for those who ever have that chance to listen to the chaz, when he says, "Mi yichya mi yomus," when it comes to the sanas tokef. So that's his time to start preparing. So now here we are. This is exactly where we are, I would say, during this period of Bein Kesel La'Asar, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So this is where we're going to be preparing. And finally, on Yom Kippur, that's where we're going to take action. We're going to say vidui, and we're going to make commitments. What's going to be different about this year? So Yom HaKippur is action. And then I would say Sukkos. Sukkos is the, I would say that's the beginning of the maintenance, which is probably kept up on Rosh Chodesh, every day during davening, a whole bunch of different strategies that we use to keep up the concept of maintenance. So how's this sound so far? It's all very good. We all think about it for ourselves. And then the challenge of termination at the end is going to be, you know, fighting the relapse when we go back, when we move forward. But this is the stages of Prochaska's development in terms of a change. So that's all fine and good. And I think we're all like, I could do that. I can hear that. Everyone's thinking like, okay, so where am I? Well, maybe in this I'm going to be over here. On that I'm going to be over there. But there is one major problem. The problem is that that's not really what is, at first glance, what is presented by the Rambam. The Rambam, in the Perek Beis, and I have a little outline that has, you can give it out at the end. For anybody who wants, I Xerox some of the essay. He has a book, but also an essay from Prochaska, where it has the six stages of change and the notes from the Shir. I noticed that I put the wrong Rambam. It's Beis Dalet. So you can get it at the end. But the Rambam says that Midarke HaTshuva, from the path of Tshuva, this is in Perek Beis Halacha Dalet, the Rambam says something amazing, that Lios Hashav Tzoek Tomid Lefnei Hashem, a person who returns, goes through this process of renewal, screaming always before God, and he constantly does tzedakah, and he is Misrachik Harbi Min HaDavar Shechatabo, he totally distanced himself from where he was, and then the Rambam says, O Mishana Shmo, he changes his name. Kolomar, She'ani acher ve'eini oso ho'ish she'osa osan ha'maisim. I'm not that person anymore. I'm not the person who did those things. This is what the Rambam tells us. And I say to myself, wait a second. Is that reality? Can I honestly say, I look back in the previous years, I could say after I've gone through the process of tshuva, I'm not the same person? The type of dramatic transformation that the Rambam is talking about, it's jaw-dropping. It's so intense, it's almost overwhelming. And the Gemara tells a similar story. The Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah tells a story in Daf Yud Zayin of a man named Elazar ben Dordaya. And this man pursued all the worldly pleasures, every vice he could find. And he would travel the world. Finally, he comes upon one woman who puts him in his place. And he realizes his life is full of absolute hot air. Absolutely nothing. So the Gemara says that he goes out to the sky and he looks up and he says, heaven and earth and the mountains, would someone help me? Would someone help me turn my life around? Could someone help me do tshuva? And just for time's sake, contracting the story, which could be a very, very long presentation. And the Gemara says that everyone answered him and said, no one can help you. And he realized there's nobody to help me except for myself. And he put his hands over his head and he sat between two mountains and he cried until his death. Such a dramatic story. And the Gemara says, Rebbe, when he heard this, Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, the great editor of the Mishnah, he heard this story and he says, wow, Bacha Rebbe V'Amar, he cried. And he said, Yesh Kone Olomo B'Sha Achas. A person can acquire their whole world in one moment. Because the heavenly voice came out and said, this Rebbe Elazar ben Dordaya, this rabbi, he got smicha on the spot from a heavenly voice, you are invited to the world to come. So many use that story in terms of the power of tshuva, but I ask myself, wait a second. How does that story have anything to do with me? Does the Ribbono Shel Olam want me to go sit outside on the corner of Crawford and Dempster and sit there until I cry my eyes out? Until my neshama chas v'shalom? Is that what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants me to do? But for the Rambam, it sounds like almost like that's where we're looking. And now I have this very big challenge. Because on the one hand, I could see myself going through these steps of change and figuring out where I'm going to be. But to say that I'm going to accomplish all of this right now, right here, this Yom Kippur, Tav Shin Ayin Hey, I'm thinking, I don't know. I don't know if I can say I'm not that person. You know, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, he was wont of saying, that it's easier to learn all of Shas than it is to change one Midah Ra, one negative character trait. So you know how long it takes to learn all of Shas? I have not yet learned all of Shas. And I've been learning in Yeshiva for a long time. So the Ribbono Shel Olam expects me, the Rambam expects me, if he were to walk in the door right now, he would tell me right now that I have to change everything. Eini Oso Ha'ish, I'm not that person anymore. How is that possible? What does that even mean? So I think that maybe we should consider that it's true, but maybe from a different perspective. So imagine for a second you planned a vacation. And you were going on vacation this coming summer, Haba Aleinu Latova, and you decided after doing a lot of research that you wanted to go to Vienna. You wanted to see the historic city center of Vienna. You wanted to see the Baroque castles and the Schönbrunner Gardens. And all you've been thinking about for 6 months from now until you're ready to go is that you're going to see Vienna, one of the great historic cities in Europe. So you're thinking, this is fabulous. It's amazing. You can't wait. You count it down. You have that the voter's guide. You know, you're going through every page. And you're really excited. You're going to see Vienna. So finally the day comes and you go to O'Hare, you check in, your flight, it says on the thing, Vienna, you board the plane. You fly, it's about, whatever, 7, 8, 9 hours, and then you land. And you step off the gate and you walk up the jetway and you see signs, and the signs are in Hungarian. And you ask someone in English, you say, excuse me, are we in Vienna? And they say, you're not in Vienna, you're in Budapest. Budapest. No disrespect to anyone of Hungarian descent in this room. But I've been planning for 6 months. I want to be in Vienna. I'm not in Vienna. I'm not in Austria. I'm in Hungary, for God's sake. I don't want to be in Hungary. I want to be in Vienna. So I see the pilot getting off the plane. And I say to him, excuse me, sir. Where were we going today on this plane? And he says, I'll tell you, well, there was a little bit of a miscue. We were supposed to go to Vienna. But you know, every time they have a flight plan, we have a specific flight plan of how we're going to go. I realized when I look back now, the flight plan, it was off by 1 degree. And it happens to be that if you travel about 4,600 miles, and you're off just by 1 degree, you're going to be about 150 miles off. And it happens to be that Budapest is exactly 150 miles from Vienna. So that's where we ended up. So meanwhile, you're thinking to yourself, first of all, how am I going to get out of here? But the second thing you're thinking is, how did that happen? How could it be that if your flight plan was off by 1 degree, you were supposed to be going 46 degrees, you were going 47, you ended up in a different country?
Hour. But if you look in the beginning of the Chumash, where the word first appears, says the Holy Midrash Ramakid, the word Sha'a appears in a different context. Because Kayin and Hevel each brought a carbon, but Kayin's carbon was not as appreciated by the Ribbono Shel Olam as Hevel's. So it says, Vayisha Hashem El Hevel. God turned, Vayisha, Vav Yud Shin Ayin, he turned to the carbon of Hevel. Ve'el Kayin ve'el Menchaso lo Sha'a. He didn't turn. Says the Holy Mizritcher Magid, one of the great giants of Hasidus. He says, the Ribbono Shel Olam asks us to make one turn.
Yesh kona olomo b'sha achas. It doesn't mean in 1 hour that we should all sit outside like Rabbi Elazar ben Derdaya and leave the world. Just make one turn. And what I would suggest to you is that it's not just, and some would say, well, kirchok mizrach mimarav, well, you could stand facing this way, and you can make a turn, and now you're facing a totally different direction. But if you think about it, you don't even have to make a 180-degree turn. 1 degree. It's already a whole different country. It's a whole different place. I'd venture to guess that if we took a show of hands, how many people in this room have been to the Lincoln Park Zoo? Many people. So I don't know how many people have been to the Regenstein Center for African Apes. Oh, very nice, right? It's Gewaldig, the Regenstein Center for African Apes. It's very wonderful. It's great. Oh, they have baby gorillas. So did you ever go to the Regenstein Center for African Apes? And you look in, they have a chimpanzee exhibit. And you ever look in there and you think, wow, you know what? We're basically the same. Did you ever think that when you go visit the chimpanzees, you're looking in the thing, and you're basically the same? Certainly I would never tell my kids that. Those are chimpanzees. We're people. But did you know that the difference between us and them is about 1.2% of our DNA? 1%? You could have told me it's 50%. I would have told you that makes a lot of sense. That thing's an ape. It's a chimpanzee. It's a bonobo. I'm a human being. But it's 1%. Sha'achas, 1% change means you're a different Bria. You're not the same person. So perhaps that's the pshat in the Rambam. In Achanami, the Rambam says that when we go through this process of transformation, we're not. I'm not the same person. But it doesn't mean I have to transform everything every year, every time. Because if I just make one fundamental change, if I make one turn, one shah, I'm not the same person that I was. It's a totally different person. And so if we turn to thinking about how it can apply to each of us practically, so every person, lev yodemos maris nafsho, each one of us, we need to think about what it means for us. For this year, for this time, for this shah. Did you notice that this year is tough? Shin, ayin, hey? Tehei hashah hazos. This is the year of the shah, if there was any year. What is it that's going to be my shah? What's going to be my turn? Not 180 degrees, not even 90 degrees, 1 degree. But it's 1 degree that's fundamental, that's really profound. So this could be in any realm. So there is a comment of the Vilna Gaon in his commentary in Yeshaya, in the first chapter of Yeshaya, and it's a very helpful way of kind of putting a frame for how we want to structure our focus. He says, there are three aspects of our lives. There are mitzvos that are responsibilities, bein adam lechaveiro, interpersonal. Then there are responsibilities, there are mitzvos that are bein adam lemakom, between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam. And then there are the responsibilities that are what he calls, interestingly, midos shel atzmo, my responsibilities to myself, my character traits, my personality, my moral compass. We can call it bein adam le'atzmo. So we need to think about what is our shah in which context? Is it one of each? Is it one of any of them? Is it going to be bein adam le'chaveiro in the way that I treat someone else? Is it going to be bein adam le'makom in the way that I cultivate my relationship with the Almighty? Is it going to be bein adam le'atzmo in the type of person that I am and the type of person that I become? But I would like to suggest tonight one specific area that actually cuts through all three of these realms. It impacts bein adam lechaveiro, the way we relate to others. It impacts bein adam lemakom, the way that we follow the commandments of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it also impacts bein adam leatzmo, a person, how it reflects on himself, how a person reflects on themselves. I have a little Vidui packet at home. It's very old school. We grew up with it in my parents' house. It's like published in 1970-something. It's been around for a very long time. And it's a Vidui packet where they have English translations of the different Vidui things, and I find it very helpful because it actually explains to me what I'm saying, and the more important thing than to just rattle off the words is to actually know what it is that I'm supposed to be thinking about and working on in Yom Kippur as we articulate, as we verbalize all of these different areas that we want to think about in terms of goal setting. So in the introduction to this Vidui packet, they have one page, and it says you should take note that 194 times over Yom Kippur, we are going to acknowledge missteps through the use of speech. Chazal, the word mafli, which means in Hebrew a wonder, relates to the world of speech. Speech defines us as human beings. Vayipach ba'apav ruach chayim. God blew into our nostrils a living spirit. So Unkelus there translates ruach mamalala, a speaking spirit. So our capacity for speech, that enables us to connect with others and really weave together a society. To build the world as we know it, it's enabled because of speech. And the impact of positive speech is so transformational, it's astounding. The Yerushalmi, in the middle, beginning of Maseches Peah, tells the following story, that there was a very, very unsavory character. His name was Achav. Achav was not from the most righteous of the kings of Israel. And yet, the Yerushalmi says that his armies were victorious. Wherever he went, he had military success. And the Yerushalmi asked, the Talmud Yerushalmi says, why was Achav so successful? During his reign, there was rampant idolatry. But the Yom of the Yerushalmi says it's because there were no Dalturin. People didn't speak negatively about each other. And because there was that cohesive use of speech, the power of speech was able to overcome even that which we thought would be insurmountable. The mistake of Avodah Zarah. But we had the proper speech. The Vilna Gaon, who we mentioned before, at one point in his life traveled to Israel. He didn't make it, but he did travel to Israel. And he left behind him something very, very interesting, which was a letter to his mother. So it's already an interesting thing. If you happen to be one of the greatest rabbinic luminaries in the last thousands of years, so one of the treasures that he left to us is a letter to his mom. And he writes at the beginning of the letter, basically, Ma, don't be sad. A lot of people travel for business. A lot of people go on long trips. And I need to go to Israel. It's an amazing thing. You wouldn't think that the Vilna Gaon need to write his mother a letter, but he did. Which is a good lesson to us that we should all write letters to our mother. Anyway, this letter is not exactly the average letter that you would write to your mother because it contains many, many ethical principles that he's reminding his mother that everybody should learn in his absence. And the Vilna Gaon was an extremely pious and saintly individual. And one of the things that he tells his mother in the letter, he writes, just remember, V'chol rega, I'm not suggesting you write this to your mother in the letter, but this is what he writes. V'chol rega v'rega sha'odam chosim piv. Every time a person has that thought to speak something negative and they close their mouth, zoche lo'or hagonuz, they receive, they merit the holy light, she'ein malach ubirya yecholam l'sha'er, that no heavenly angel can even imagine. We all know that this world is just a hallway. It's a waiting room. The mission says in Pirkei Avos, this world is like a prose door. The next world, the world to come, is the trochlin. So we should prepare ourselves in the prose door, in the waiting room, so that we'll be prepared. That's the ultimate world. Now, it happens to be, sometimes to go to a doctor's office, you spend an awful lot of time in the waiting room. So we spend 70, 80, hopefully, good 90 good years, maybe 120. But that's it. At a certain point, there's a limit to how much time you're going to spend in the waiting room. And then you're going to go into the real room. So we all know our life, deep down, we know it's guided by this principle that our world, what we accomplish here, is going to be something we take with us. We don't take with us our house or our car. We take with us that which we have accomplished spiritually. So if we can imagine, the Vilna Gaon is telling his mom, he's like, Ma, realize that every time we have this opportunity to be cautious about speech, we're going to achieve for ourselves such an incredible spiritual gift that we will have earned for ourselves in the world to come. And part of the challenge here is what we started with. Because this is obviously, on some level, this topic is like, oh God, he's talking about Shemiras HaLashon again for the 1,000th time. And it's impossible. The Gemara says in Maseches Brachot Basra that every day a person invariably is going to trip up with Avak Lashon Hara. So like, what are we trying to kid ourselves? But if we understand that it's not about 180 degrees, if it's about 1%, 1 degree, one small move, but if that is sustained and inherent and part of who we are, then we're not the same person. And so I will give you an opportunity, a suggestion, if anybody would like to do this. But I could tell you that these are words that could change your life, and they were certainly words that changed my life. Because last year, someone got for my wife, Nechama, they got her a present, they got her a gift, and it is this book, the biography of Rebbetzin Batsheva Kanievsky. So this book is a very unusual book about a very unusual person. Now, there's an important caveat that when you read about the Kanievsky family, you have to remember, they're living in a different existence that's for Yechidei Segula, only for singular individuals in several generations, not just one generation. But this is a woman whose father was the Gaon Rav Yosef Sholem Elyashiv, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, whose grandfather was the Tzadik Rav Ari Levin, whose husband, Yibor L'Chaim Tovin, is Rav Chaim Kanievsky, one of the world leaders and Torah giants. And her name is Batsheva. The Rebbetzin Batsheva Kanievsky. They have many pictures of her in here. This is one of them. And she lives in a tiny apartment in Bnei Brak, and her life is a very, very unusual one. And the book describes how she was a source of chizuk and inspiration for not hundreds, not thousands, tens of thousands of women all around the world who used to come to their apartment to meet with her for a bracha, for advice. And it's almost uncanny how she's able to bridge the otherworldly existence that she's living in the spiritual world, yet at the same time to be able to relate to average, ordinary, regular people who came to visit with her. So I was picking up this book and I saw many of the inspirational stories. And in the back, they have a selection of appendices. And they have a letter in the appendix that she wrote. So she writes, "Dear women and girls," and I'm reading it, so this time it also be "Dear women, girls, and boys." So she writes this open letter, "We need you to help us with prayers. The situation in Eretz Yisrael is very difficult. Lately, we are suffering terrible losses, many orphans and widows from different diseases." And she describes how her husband, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, opened the Gemara and said that we need to work on our speech. She quotes an article from Rav Yehuda Zev Segal, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Manchester, who was a disciple of the Chafetz Chaim, who said, Rav Segal, that he never saw a person who learned two halachas of Shmiras Haloshen every day and didn't see a salvation. Now, I can't tell you whether this applies to anyone or everyone, but this is the statement which is made. And while I think we should all be careful about promises, spiritual promises that people make us, to me, when I saw this, I'm like, wait a second, this woman is a very pious lady. She probably has, if anybody has a red phone to the Ribbono Shel Olam, she's got it. And if she's saying that you should learn two halachas of Shmiras Haloshen in a day, how long could it possibly take? Seriously, how long could it take? So, and she writes later on in the letter that we witnessed miracles that happened to people who took upon themselves two halachas every day and saw Yeshuas. She says, again, this is not me, this is her writing this letter. "While I was reading the article, a woman walked in crying and said she has a number of adult daughters who are still not married. I showed her the article. Immediately she said that she will learn two halachas of Shmiras Haloshen every day." And usually when I read these stories, I become very skeptical. I'm not so convinced, but this is, she said, this happened to her. It happened to her. "Within 3 days, one daughter got engaged. And several months later, another daughter. She saw many Yeshuas." And she says, we should all take upon ourselves, Belinator, to learn to Allahas of Shmiras Halashon every day and pray with great kavana. That's what it says. So I figured, how hard could it be? And the truth is, it's not so hard. So, this is a good, it's like a good test about self-reflection. What's on your night table? What's on your night table? So I went down to my bookshelf, and I have this sefer. Now, I don't want to say how much dust was collecting on this sefer, unfortunately. This is called the Sefer Chavetz Chaim. It's authored by Rav Yisrael HaKohen Kagan of Radin of Poland, who was an incredibly pious man. He died over the age of 100 in the early 1930s. He had a famous yeshiva. He authored many works, and this is his most famous work. So I picked up the sefer. It happens to be that this sefer was given to me as a gift when I learned in Karen B'Yavne, and it has a little inscription that it's in memory of all the boys at that time in the yeshiva who had served in Tzahal and were killed al Kiddush Hashem. But it had been sitting on my shelf. So I opened it up, and I started to learn two halachas a day. And I can tell you, eini osoish. I still speak Lashon Hara all the time, which the Chafetz Chaim would say is not a good thing to say to other people, because you're not supposed to say Lashon Hara about yourself, but just for educational purposes for the moment. I say Lashon Hara all the time, so how can I say eini osoish? But the answer is, I'm not the same person, because now at least I'm a little bit more sensitive. I'm a little bit more in tune to what's going to come out of my mouth or what I'm going to listen to from somebody else. And little by little, so maybe, you know, if you do the math, and this is why I needed Nechama's help, because she knows something about math and science, and thank God for Google, I was trying to make a cheshbon, what happens if you take a distance and spread it apart 1 degree at a time? You're right, if you go a few miles, it's not going to be that much, but after 4,500 miles, you'll be the difference between Vienna and Budapest. So everybody needs to think about what Kabbalah's, what area of focus, what small thing they can do. But what's amazing and transformational about this is that it applies across the board, because it's true for Bein Adam LaChaveiro, because it impacts the way that you build relationships with speech. It impacts Bein Adam LaMakom, because the Chafetz Chaim, the way that he begins, and if anybody would like, you can see me afterwards, you can call any of our local bookstores or any of the online. You can get, this is the Hebrew version. It also comes with the Shmiras Halashon, which is like the theory in the back. They also have, they published this Rav Segal, Zechorna Levracha, from Manchester himself. There's a different thing called A Lesson a Day, but this is the Chavetz Chaim translated and kind of summarized in English called The Daily Companion. I happen to know a certain Rebbe in one of our day schools learns this with his students every day, just one page. Just one page. So this is in English. It's also true, Bein Adam LaMakom, because the Chavetz Chaim begins with a whole litany. I mean, you can't get through the number of serious mitzvos and requirements that are involved in the mitzvos of speech. And finally, it's Bein Adam LaAtzmo, because a person who becomes sensitive, and we've all met people like this who are sensitive and refined in their speech, it reflects something about their character, about the Bein Adam LaAtzmo, about the people and how they relate to themselves. So everybody can find something, but I was thinking that this year, this may be something as a suggestion that some might want to consider. And I'll close with one final story. There was a man who was a very accomplished Olympic runner. And he had a son, a teenage son, who was very enamored with this sport, with track. And he would practice all the time, and his dad was so proud of him. And he had many conversations and many late nights about what it was like to be an Olympic runner, to be a great athlete, and to accomplish great things, you know, out there on the track. And the boy says, Dad, you know what, I would like to go to a college where I can be trained, where I can be mentored, I can learn the craft, not just in high school, but to continue on my education about running. On the cross country. So the father says, no problem. He's going to go across the United States to a college where they specify in training their students in cross country. So it's very far, and the father's not a wealthy, particularly wealthy individual. So he doesn't have the opportunity to come and visit them all the time. So he sends him off at the beginning of the fall term, fall semester, and he doesn't hear too much from his son. Son sends him occasional emails, texts. Everything is great. It's going great. No problems. Father doesn't want to pry. Finally, happens to be that he has a business requirement. He has to be on the other coast, like toward the end of the year. And it's his opportunity to check in on his son. He hasn't seen him in nearly a whole year. He hasn't come back. They haven't seen each other. So he's very excited. He's going to finally see his son. He's going to see his dorm room. He's going to see everything he's got going on there. And he arrives at the door. He knocks on the son's dorm room. The son opens the door. He gives him a big hug. And he says, "Hi, Dad!" And he gives him a huge hug. His dad looks at him. And he says, "Son, what happened to you?" And he says, "Dad, what do you mean?" And the dad looks at him. He says, "Son, he says, you are totally out of shape. Look at you. You must have gained 40 pounds since you've come here." And the boy is looking at him. He's not even sure what to say because he didn't even realize. He's looking at himself. He says nothing. The dad says, "What have you been doing?" He says, "Well, you know, I took a couple of classes, and then they had this group that gets together." And he says, "But what about running? You came here for running." And the kid can't even look at him in the eye. He says, "You know, the truth is that I didn't really focus on running so much this year, Dad." And the father's like, "You gave up a whole year of your life. You traveled all the way across the country. You invested so much. And you're totally out of shape. You haven't run at all. Don't you know that then in just a few weeks, there's going to be a qualifying race?" So the boy looks at him and he says, "You know what, Dad? I promise you that I'm going to try my best. I'm going to start right now. Tonight, I'm going to the track. I'm going to see if I can make it for this race." And the father says, "Son, I'm so glad you're committed. You know what? When I get home, I know a guy. I have a friend from back in the day who he does some training on the side. I'm going to hire him. You know, it's going to be costly, but I'm going to hire him. And he's going to work with you for the next month. He's going to work with you to make this qualifier. He's going to be your trainer." The kid says, "No problem. It's great." So meanwhile, the next morning he gets up at the crack of dawn. The trainer is there, and they're out there running. And he's practicing for week after week. Finally, after a month, he's got the qualifier. And the qualifier comes around and the trainer says, "Look, this is it's a very big track. And what I'm going to do is, for the first three quarters, I'll pace you. I'm going to run with you on the side." So the kid's got a lot of chizuk. He knows that he's got his mentor, he's got his trainer, he's going to make this happen. So the gun goes off and he starts running. And he's got his trainer and he's running and he's focused. And he does his first lap, and his second lap, and his third lap, and finally he's coming into the third lap. And the trainer says, "Okay, son, you're on your own now." And he's tired. He's working his best. He's pushing as hard as he can because he knows he's got to beat that clock. And as he makes the final turn, just as he's making it around the bend to see the finish line, he sees, just kind of out of the crowd, a hand waving at him. And he sees, he says to himself, "Oh my gosh, that's my dad." And there is the great Olympic runner, his father standing there just past the finish line, waving out there, cheering him on. He's saying, "Go, son." He can't hear him, but he can only see his words. He's saying, "Go." There's no one else who's going to help him finish this race. He knows right now he's got to finish the race all by himself. In a certain sense, we spent the whole year maybe in pre-contemplation. We're not necessarily focused on running. Comes Elul, the marshal knocks on our door, and we say, "Wait a second, I don't know about anybody else, but maybe I haven't done enough running." So he says, "Don't worry, I'll hire you a tutor. We'll have somebody blow the horn every day for the next month." But that person, now all of a sudden, during a Aseres Yemei Teshuva, that horn is gone, and now we're off to the races. We need to start thinking about not just preparation, but now we need to start thinking about action. And we realize that at this point in the race, as we're entering Yom Kippur, there's no mentor, there's no horn, there's nothing, it's just us. Says the Rabbam, Chayav lehisfaros lefnei hakel baruch hu. It's just us and the Almighty when we have that conversation this Friday night. But the great thing that we started with, and we need to remember that confidence, is that the Ribbono Shel Olam is standing at the finish line. He is urging us on. He's saying, Rabba emunasecha. We can find some way, with the help of the Ribbono Shel Olam, to make that shah, to make that turn. Every person is going to find their own way, whether it's through their method of speech, whether it's learning two halachas of Shmiras HaLashon, whether it's whatever they're going to do. But to take this year, the year of the Shah, to make that turn, and to be Kona Olamo, to acquire an entire year. I bless all of us that we should merit this year to a Shnas Chaim V'Shalom, to a year of good health and peace and good news for each one of us and to individually, for our community collectively, and for all of Klal Yisrael. Thank you.